More cars, more people.
Wasn't that a song by Notorious B.I.G.?
Geraldine, the police ombuds bitch.
Because he's rummaging around in the back seats.
With
And
Annie?
exactly right. Yeah, I mean, kickboxing, but also clearly a brand new skincare regime. It's so distracting.
It's got a little bit Midsummer Night's Dream.
This is not the fault of anyone acting on the screen, but I do second screen when Jen's storyline comes up.
This podcast was recorded remotely and may contain adult language and themes.
Hello and welcome to TV DNA Blue Lights, Season 2, Episode 2, Iceberg, and Episode 3, Love Knows. My name is Adam Hemming, and joining me on the Mount Eden estate are two very sexy idiots. Firstly, Grace Chapman.
Ugh, the problem with you Nordies is you love chaos.
And also with us, it's Damien Cooper.
What does a nobody like ye want with me?
Well, I thought we might talk about Blue Lights, Season 2, Episodes 2 and 3. But yeah, there will be spoilers ahead for those two episodes. So if you haven't quite got through the third episode of Blue Lights, this is your spoiler warning. Go back and fire those up on the iPlayer and then come back and listen to us. Yeah, so continuing on, as expected, some cracking dialogue, some great scenes, a lot of tension. What are you particularly enjoying, Grace?
I'm particularly enjoying, the rising, simmering tension. I think there were some great moments in episode 2 where we really got to sit in that and enjoy that. I am intrigued about all the love storylines. I don't know where I'm at with them right now. Some I prefer more than others. There seems to be a lot, maybe more than we need. And I'm also really intrigued about how Jen the satellite is going to come into the main plot.
How about you, Damo?
Yes. So full disclosure, gang, I've caved. I've watched all 6 episodes, but I will remain firm. So anyone who has quite legitimate concerns about me giving further spoilers, fear not. I will be kept honest by Adam and Grace. Yeah, well, I would say I have no qualms at all with episodes 2 and 3, other than, as you said, Grace, the tension seemed to be simmering as much on Mount Eden as they do in the bedroom. And I'm not sure how much I'm digging it either. It feels a little bit like, let's just pair everyone off, shall we? It's got a little bit Midsummer Night's Dream.
Well, let's get into episode 2 then. So we open with Tommy on his date with Aisling, picking up litter on his way, which I thought was lovely. She's watching him approach and he's picking up litter. Such a Boy Scout. But yeah, they're having their date in a truck stop, which is exactly halfway between Belfast and Derry.
Yeah, and I think we can all agree that the woman who runs the truck stop was the scene stealer here. In fact, the line, "I can give you mushy peas and you can pretend it's avocado," made my heart sing. I would like a spin-off series with her and Tina. I'm just saying.
We get a bit of an explanation of Tommy's bulking out and that he's been kickboxing. And then they also talk about the fact that he called and didn't text and how that was strong, which I felt was perhaps overplaying it a little bit. We got the message last time round. But I did enjoy her saying, "You definitely took a beat though," which is a nice callback again to the kill room.
Yeah, I mean, kickboxing, but also clearly a brand new skincare regime. It's so distracting. I'm sorry, we just have to talk about this. I know we've only just got started, but we've just got to talk about it for 1 second. Are they all wearing blue contacts? What's going on?
So Maluka said to me, it shouldn't be called blue lights, it should be called blue eyes. The amount of blue peelers, peepers that we can see are mental. It's like nearly everyone has blue eyes.
I know, I'm so confused. It's weird. Let's move on. But yeah, I like this. I think this is one of the romances I can kind of get behind. You know, this is kind of a slow burn. It's kind of cute. This is all good.
Yeah. I think later on we learn that Aisling, I think this is in episode 3, but Aisling's going to come and volunteer for reasons which we'll get into. So we're going to be seeing a bit more of her on the screen, which is good. But there is a fire that Annie and Shane have to attend to. The fire service is 5 minutes out and they conduct, probably not the right word, a rescue of a woman and child who are in the bedroom on the first floor. What did you think of this section?
Good. I mean, it's good to see them kind of doing the hard graft. The kind of proper dirty hands response policing. There was some real jeopardy there. I mean, obviously Annie was always getting out and Shane was as well. Also, just obviously you can see there's more money in the show just from how that is done, I think. And I think, wow, Shane is such a hero. He's such a great guy. I mean, oh, he's so dreamy. He couldn't possibly do anything wrong, could he?
To flag to listeners, you know, Damo had this theory in episode one, so this has nothing to do with him having seen the rest of the show. I guess what it did for their relationship is it made you realise kind of how similar they are, right? They're both quite fearless, quite protective, brave, stupid, all in one. So I like that. I think that scene was really good to kind of cement that relationship and the development of that. The handhold at the end was great.
There's a big explosion before Shane makes it out. And Catherine was like, how on earth has he survived that moment? So there was a little bit of a fake out again that Shane might have bit the bullet. But yeah, it was far too early in his storyline for that to be the case. Then we learn that it's Dixie's girlfriend and son that are being rescued, essentially. So Dixie turns up right at the end. And that is obviously key later on. The thing that I really enjoyed was the fact that Annie and Shane then had to go and attend a briefing despite still being covered in ash.
Yeah. Wait, who's Ash?
But before we get to that briefing, there's a scene with another female returning character, Geraldine, the police ombuds bitch. Which was the note that I made. Oh, the ombuds bitch is back. But she has a little bit of a hero moment, doesn't she? Because Helen, who she had a run-in with Helen in I think the fourth episode, brilliant fourth episode, where they're all really, really hectic and there's loads of different stuff going on and Helen makes a call and this Geraldine is kind of questioning everything.
So I was doing a full moon across the sky because that's the name of the episode, Full Moon.
Lovely. Official thing for the podcast listeners. But yeah, so there's this tension between Geraldine and Helen, and she talks about them being the hindsight police. And then basically Geraldine schools Helen on what her report will say and the fact that they are on the same side, which I thought was a lovely moment for Geraldine.
Maybe one day you'll come to realise we're on the same side is what she says, yeah?
Yeah.
But it's Grace that she's talking to about this incident, which is clearly affecting Grace, clearly playing on her mind, the fact that she nearly shot somebody. But Stevie makes it all better with pork belly sausage rolls with capsicum and chili jam.
I've got so much to say about this scene. Firstly, this is a man who takes Tupperware very seriously. The little, what was it? It was like a little container for the dipping sauce. Basically, you know, Stevie has exactly the same number of tubs as lids.
You know, the other show we're talking about is Shogun. It's kind of almost, I think it's quite similar culturally to kind of the Japanese focus on ritual and placement. I think there's loads of that in the first series as well. He takes his lunch incredibly seriously, doesn't he?
It's clearly his favourite meal of the day.
It's the little four clicks on each side of the Tupperware lid that he, you know, is part of the process for him. Yeah, brilliant stuff.
We get a bit of foreshadowing, don't we, at the end with you still want to be friends. And she's like, of course you idiot. And you're like, oh no.
But they're talking at this briefing about the fact that there may well be some reprisals. So Dixie's house has been firebombed and they're sort of concerned about all of this. They then send out our six heroes in cars. It seems like they're the only six police officers who get to drive around in a car. But there is conflict here. I think this is what you were alluding to last episode, Damo, between Manning and Helen and their kind of contradictory orders. Like Helen's telling people to be careful and not to sort of stoke the fires, and Manning saying, no, put yourselves about and get in people's faces.
What the fuck are you doing? You don't give operational orders to a response section.
Delightful. I love it. As the series goes on, that relationship gets even better. I don't think that's necessarily a spoiler, but the kind of back and forth between the two of them. I think also their styles of leadership we see as well. One is safety of her officers is the priority. The other is results, and it doesn't matter how you get them. And we see this throughout the series, but I guess we also have moments of it specifically in these two episodes as well.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, the next scene is Lee and Tina at the Titanic Museum. And I think the main takeaway from this was that Lee is a survivor.
And Tina I mean, what do we think of the Titanic metaphor? A little heavy-handed there? Are we feeling okay about it?
Oh, look, don't worry. Those sorts of heavy-handed stuff is going to continue in this series, trust me. But I guess also, right, they're in Belfast. What else are they going to put in there as part of the Visit Belfast package that they are offering? Because there is an element of this, right, is that it is a postcard of Belfast.
What, you think someone's like, oh, I've just seen blue light. Should we go to Belfast?
This guy right here.
He can do the Game of Thrones tour. They love that. Now, I want to talk a bit about Jonty. So Jonty is the... I can't remember whether we found this out in the first episode or not, but he's the guy they're going to bring in because he's the one who knows the neighbourhood well. They've got no assets, no insights and no intelligence, but he knows the area. He has a lovely line of, when approached by Helen, of, are you wise? Which I quite like as a Northern Irish saying. But yeah, she says he owes the section. And this kind of plays out throughout the episodes, I think. But what do we think it was that Jonty did wrong in season one?
Well, I was hoping you would answer that as having recently watched season one.
I do think, because this is a recurring thing throughout the series, and I do think it's a little bit of a stretch. But obviously, when whatever was going on with MI5 or whatever, and the gang that Jerry walked in on, so Jonty was part of that. He was complicit in what they were doing, and he wasn't giving the response team all the information they needed. He was just saying where the people, that places were OOB, and that's all he was giving. So I think part of it is that he was complicit in the... I can't fucking speak. Sorry, Adam, you have your hand up.
Obfuscation is the word you're going for.
I mean, I was going for that, but you had also your hand up before I started tripping over my own tone.
Yeah, but isn't there an element of that, of him just doing his job, right? Like, there was a quite closed circle around the information of that mission, if you like. So he's being instructed by MI5 not to tell loads of people. I guess his crime is probably not taking it to his superiors, perhaps. And obviously, the results of what happens are tragic. But I just feel it's a little bit unbalanced that he's so heavily blamed for all of this.
I agree. That's what I mean. It feels a bit stretched. And I do think that this is an issue with this series as it carries on. I don't want to go into too much until we get to those episodes. But I do think there are some things that are stretched a little bit beyond credulity as the season progresses.
Let's move on then. So we then see Mags playing chess with Henry. And I wonder whether you remember the advice that she gives to Henry about his chess play.
No, what was it?
She says, don't be so aggressive with your opening. And I just wondered whether that was advice that either of you had ever received. But Lee's brought CP's ashes home and they have a conversation, Lee and Mags, about why they stay. He tells her she's got a choice. I think he's kind of saying, you know, you could go because it's going to get hairy. But basically he's saying he's going to change stuff and she should trust him. And then the band start coming in and she says, it's not marching season. And he says it is now. The whole march, which is kind of the central plot element of this second episode, right? Lee is organising a march in honour of Soupy, but they are not supposed to be marching during this time. He doesn't ask Dixie for Dixie's permission to march, which is something he should be doing. And as soon as the police hear about the march happening, they are kind of all there straight away.
Just something that made me think about this. Obviously, marching season, I believe, is in July. One of the most famous marches, Orange Marches, is the 12th of July. But what I noticed, also having rewatched season one, is when do they film this? The weather is always really good in Blue Lights. And I know that Northern Ireland is not renowned for the best weather. I know that it spends a lot of time being dark and cold and rainy, and there is hardly any rain in this show whatsoever.
It's all part of the Northern Irish tourist conspiracy.
So while we're on Little Henry, I've got a very small theory that I can't really back up. But I wonder if Henry is Jonty's son. Damo's not saying anything.
I can neither confirm nor deny. But I think what is confirmed is that Jonty has a history with that area. He knows Mags. Now, it could be that that's just one scene and then we never really hear anything more about it. Or it could be something more significant.
He's got a history with the area and a history of affairs. So I'm just saying, that conversation just sort of made me think, huh, this feels a bit emotional, that conversation that wasn't just about the kind of the stuff that was happening outside the pub. But anyway, I'll park that. I'll see what episode 4 and 5 are saying. But yeah, I like this scene. What does Lee say? I don't want to leave here, but I don't want to live like this. Why do we accept it? So he's on a bit of a mission, isn't he, to change their luck a bit?
Yeah, I think his mission becomes clearer as I've watched the fourth episode. I think that becomes a bit clearer when you get into episode 4. But I do worry about little Henry. I think in episode 3, I think it's Rab who tells him to stay away from Uncle Lee for a bit. I'm concerned about him as a character. I think he's definitely vulnerable. But yeah, the whole march, the kind of reason for the march, I think, is to bring Dixie and Davy Hamill together face to face in front of the police, which is kind of the result of what happens. So the police turn up, tell them they've got to stop the march. He asks if they can just march back to the pub, and Sandra allows that to happen. And as they leave, Dixie and Davy Hamill are left squaring off against each other after, well, a couple of events has happened. I think that actually one of the things that comes up shortly after this chess scene is that there is a reprisal for the petrol bombing of the house. And that is that Keith beats up Gareth, Davy's son. And that's witnessed by Tommy and Sandra. Yeah, Tommy chases after him, doesn't he? And thumps him. And gets called Carl Frampton. All right, there, Carl Frampton.
I have to say that the kids interjecting in any kind of big scene, or you hear a little shout from some young kid, is like one of my favourite things about Blue Lights. When he's running down the street after the man, and you just hear "Run, Forrest, run!" Like, so good. And then I think at one point someone goes, "Fuck off, Inspector Gadget."
Because someone in the ADR session had an absolute whale of a time.
Why you need the subs on, listeners? Put the subs on, you catch it all.
Yeah, some cracking one-liners and dialogue in this. Where should we go next? Should we talk about Jen, Damo?
Well, what I will say is, so this guy that's been collected, he has a swastika, he has a Combat 18 tattoo. So this dude is not just a loyalist paramilitary, but also a neo-Nazi. He is already saying some quite... Well, I can't remember if he's actually racist to Sandra or not, but he makes it very clear, his views on race. And he also says to Tommy, "I'm making sure I remember your face." He makes that threat that he's going to remember who he is for what he's done to him.
Mm-hmm. And then we get the lovely line from Sandra, "Let's get you into a nice warm cell where you belong."
Should we cover Jen then in this? We probably cover Jen in both episodes, right? Because she's basically investigating the chip shop bombing, and she believes there's a case to be answered. She takes it to her boss and persuades her boss that she can explore this. And it leads her to Robin Graham, played by that chap off Casualty.
Charlie.
I thought he was really good in this, actually.
He is fantastic in this. I don't think he really gets enough, and I don't think Happy really gets enough, but they are both absolutely brilliant. And what we find out is that he was an RUC Special Branch officer, so Royal Ulster Constabulary Special Branch, which back in that time was pretty much... Well, there was no legislation, right? So they could do whatever they wanted. They had carte blanche from the British government to keep mostly the IRA and the Catholic factions in check.
He reveals that he sued the government for PTSD for what they were asked to do, and he was threatened with prison in return. And he had a source who told him that there would be a bomb somewhere, but if he had done anything, that source would have been killed. Not a ketchup source or a brown source, Damo. Is that the question?
I was going to say, chip shop sauce.
So, yeah, if he had revealed his source, they'd have killed him. So it was apparently a test of loyalty. And he ended up running that source for another 20 years after that. And he says that his superiors knew all about this. So the chip shop bombing could have been prevented, but wasn't. That's the kind of what we learn from all of this stuff.
I have to be completely honest here. And this is not the fault of anyone acting on the screen, but I do second screen when Jen's storyline comes up. I'm sorry. I'm sad about it. I just don't really like... just taking us away from the action like that. And I don't know whether they're trying to bring the history more into Blue Lights, but I don't feel like I need that. It's everywhere, the history. It's in every scene already. So why are we having this, like, just sort of a B plot that isn't serving the A plot right now. Damo, I'm sure it comes good, great.
I'm definitely not saying that. All I'm saying is, I think this series does try and do a lot more, the second series, than the first series did, not necessarily achieving everything that it's going for. And I think maybe there are elements of, like I said before, I feel like we don't get enough of these two characters. Not Jen, I'm talking about Happy and
Robin Graham.
Robin, yeah. I think that storyline actually doesn't really get the space that it deserves. Just, I think they try to do a lot with this series and it doesn't always work.
I am glad that we have Jen and Happy back in the show. So I'm glad that they've made the effort to give them a storyline within this, because I would have been wondering about them otherwise. But yeah, let's see how it all plays out. There's another key scene for a couple of reasons where Grace sees Jim Dixon, Dixie, and stops him and searches him. He ends up pushing her and Stevie grabs him by the throat. And then Shane comes in and has another hero moment for Shane. He sort of balances out this assault by Stevie with them saving his wife and kid earlier on and persuades him not to file a complaint.
Now, I'm pretty confident that Shane found something in that car and didn't flag it, because he's rummaging around in the back seat. Sorry.
And with Annie.
Exactly right. Okay, let me try this again. Shane's searching the car, right? And I feel like he finds something, because then he shuts the door and he looks quite suspect. And I don't know if this is just because the Damo has planted the seed of doubt in my mind about Shane and his intentions in the police force. And then he's like, the car's clean, straight away to Stevie. And I was like, I'm sensing something dodgy here. Anyone else pick that up, or was it just me?
I don't think he found anything whilst rummaging in Dixie's backseat. I don't know. Maybe he did. I don't know. It's a good shout. There's definitely room for that, I think.
I've got my BDI on Shane.
Well, someone else who has their BDI on him is Annie, because she accepts the invitation to go out for a drink.
Yeah, she does, doesn't she?
Same in Sambuku or similar.
Yeah, I really like the first half of this date. I really enjoyed that. I was like, this is kind of fun, yeah. But I've got to say, the dancing made me feel very uncomfortable.
Well, we learn that he's not married, doesn't have a girlfriend, too busy being a peeler. But yeah, and then we'll pick up with them in episode 3, I guess.
The one thing I did like about the dancing, though, and I'm sure we'll get to it, is the cut to the sad cookie eating of Stevie and Grace. That was a beautiful cut.
Lovely contrast between them having a snog, Annie and Shane having a snog, and Stevie and Grace just quietly eating cookies at the station.
Yeah, I wondered also how much that was just their relative couple's ages as well.
But yeah, the other key thing that happens at the end of episode 2 is that Dixie turns up to the pub, the Loyal Pub, throws Soupy's ashes against the wall, tells Lee he's got to stop the weed and pay double for protection. And then Lee whips out his trump card, throws his keys on the table and tells him, nowhere is safe for you now. Nowhere.
Yeah. And then he goes home. He's stressed. Someone's in the house. Bang, bang.
Yeah. Close your eyes. It's easier.
That's what she said.
I was a bit, I did like Dixie as a character. I know he sort of had to go really to make it interesting, but I was enjoying him when he says to Lee, you're fucked, son, you're really fucked. It was like, oof, he really means it. I liked him, but yeah, I guess I understand why he had to go. R.I.P. Dixie.
It was Lee's mate, basically, wasn't it, who shot him? I think he's called Craig, maybe, something like that.
Scottish Craig,
there we go. Yeah, and obviously the ripples of that final moment in episode 2 cascade throughout the third episode, where we find Annie waking up in bed with Shane. Her guns are on the floor along with their clothes, and she wants him to get out without Grace seeing him. Grace comes down to find her lounging at utter mess and castigates her for bringing random guys back home. And then he comes in because he's got the news. He's received the news of Dixie.
They have quite a nice moment when they wake up amongst the awkwardness that is quite charming, I think. And they kind of, I think they're looking through pictures they've taken of themselves, which is a bit narcissistic, I have to say. Maybe that's just me showing my age. But I thought that was a bit weird. But then after that, he decides that the best thing to do would be to take a selfie of both of them in bed.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. Again, I'm like, what are you up to, pal? really don't trust him. Also, I love that she was like, you need to leave without anyone seeing. This is absolutely vital, okay? And then she's in the living room with Grace. Perfect distraction for Grace. He could have just snuck out, right? He comes barreling in. He's like, oh, Dixie's dead. I've got to go. It's like, mate, seriously? You could have just left.
Yeah, no one to leave. So we then get a scene where we go all line of duty and have a whole load of abbreviations. So I've got a few for you. MIT, Major Investigation Team. VCP.
Oh, VCP. Vera Clark Peters. Very cautious person.
Very creepy person.
Shame.
Vehicle checkpoint is the right answer.
Yeah, of course.
TSG.
Tactical Support Group.
Close.
Tactical?
Territorial Support Group.
Oh, of course. The old TSG.
But yeah, they basically need extra response officers. They're now it's really kicking off. They're concerned about a public order event, calling it Operation Brightside. And, you know, Jonty's returned. They're going to have to call Tommy back in from another date. It's all kicking off.
It's mad that it's so busy. You know, they keep telling us how understaffed this police station is, the lack of resources. And of course, everyone's got to get their time off. They've got to go to, you know, to sleep and eat and all that stuff. But it seems like 2 days in a row, Tommy's able to go off for an Ulster fry outside the city. I'm not sure that's quite how shifts work for the police, is it?
Well, he does this time go for a large fry.
And nice. A kid. He goes for it. What did we think of this? I thought it looked a little dry.
I love the fact that he closed his eyes to kiss her.
So early in advance.
It's like... I mean, I never watched it. Was it Angus snogging and thongs or whatever? It's that kind of vibe. Like, he's such a square. I love him, but he's a nerd.
It's Angus thongs and full frontal snogging, Damo. And
thank you.
It just felt a bit like a little, just a bit woodpeckery, you know? Little. But, you know, fine, let's move on. I just had to talk about it. I couldn't leave that. But yeah, no. And he gets the call and he's like, yeah, I'm on my way. Like, no question at all.
Also, sorry, before that kiss, Tommy tells her that he started working more with the detective, Murray, what's his tits, and that he's not sure about all this paramilitary stuff. And she says, yeah, it always gets messy. You got to be careful.
And just before all of that kissing stuff, there's a brief scene between Murray and Shane where he's having a go. Murray Canning, my least favourite person on the show, having a go at Shane for not doing enough. And I'm like, he's hardly been there. He's been there, what, 2 days? What was he expecting? It does have the effect of putting the pressure on Shane a little bit.
Also, not done enough. Saved a police officer's life. Saved a mother and her child. Got lucky with Annie. I mean, I think he's going through plenty.
Well, we pick up with Stevie and Grace, who are tossing coins for knocking on doors and basically getting them slammed in their faces. They do get to speak to an older resident who has a doorbell camera, and she can't give them the doorbell camera, but if they came back with a warrant, it wouldn't be wiped. So she can't be seen to be helping the police, but if she was forced to help the police, she would be quite happy to, essentially, which I thought was a brilliant, really lovely scene. But they get reassigned to this mysterious death. Should we talk about this? Let's cover this whole storyline, I think, with Stevie and Grace. So they attend this place and a chap's there and his husband is dead. He had stage 4 lung cancer, which had spread to his bones. The nurse there tells them that he still had a month or two and that some pain medication is missing. So the suspicion is that the husband has assisted his suicide, essentially. But this brings back a lot of painful memories for our Stevie.
Yeah. Well, let's just put this out into the room. What did everyone think about this storyline? Adam, what did you think?
Yeah, I think it was... I appreciated the storyline. It's probably the lamest thing that I can say. Yeah, I don't know. It was a good reminder of Stevie's past. I think it brings back sort of a lot of emotions and memories for him. So it was an interesting way to take Stevie off in a certain direction. So I plot-wise and story-wise, I didn't mind this so much. What were your issues with it?
You're sensing a tone.
Yeah.
I felt like we could have got all of that a lot quicker. I mean, in a way, even Stevie seeing that man dead in his bed with all the implements of care around him for me was probably the most powerful bit of that whole plot. And I didn't necessarily feel like I needed anything after that. Just that him seeing that would have taken him back to that place. But I did like it for the Stevie character development. I did appreciate that. I thought it was, you know, it was well written. It was respectfully done. But I was also a bit confused because doesn't like everyone need to like be on the front line or something? Like,
yeah, I think it was just quickly, what a large man he is, this husband. He was a giant, almost Hodor levels of giantness, I thought. But I think also we see, you said the progression is that last episode, or so the first episode, Stevie said Grace was a little bit social workery about something. And here we see Grace is trying to push stuff on and Stevie saying, no, like you need to think about what this guy's actually going through. Even when we get the detective turning up and being horrendous, you know, Stevie's kind of making sure that this poor man who's just lost his husband is, well, has as much psychological safety about him as he can.
Yeah. I liked all of that. I guess I just felt like it was a bit of a distraction from the main drama, but maybe that's okay.
I there were a couple of moments within this that I really, really liked, actually. The kind of, when he does eventually arrest him, I don't think there's ever been a gentler uttering of those words before. I mean, it's really, really beautifully done. And then once he's released as well, he gives him some practical advice about freezing the extra dinner that he's going to be making over the next few weeks, which again I thought was a really lovely moment. And I think I appreciate the time that it took, because I think it was necessary to get Stevie to that place at the end of the episode where he basically tells Grace that they need to take a beat work-wise and everything-wise.
Yeah, I think also just going on that thing, you know, also Stevie explaining to him the best things he can do to kind of make them believe that he has made a mistake, that it wasn't assisted suicide, it was a genuine error. But this is, and I feel like it ends up becoming a bit of an issue as the series goes on, where it seemed like a real handbrake turn from Grace's character, that she would be so cold in that moment. And I do think there are a couple of characters that are not well served in this series. And I think this is the beginning of Grace not really getting good storyline.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether it is partly what Grace was saying about our Grace, not the Grace on the show, about the fact that there is so much other stuff going on that they've got to deal with, right? That she's just trying to get this one. This is a pretty open shut case. He's got to be arrested and taken to the station because there's enough evidence or suggestion there that he's got a case to answer. And there's all this other stuff going on that we probably need to attend to. But yeah, I can see how it is a bit of a U-turn for their Grace, not our Grace. Let's go back to Lee and Tina then. So Lee and his mate get frisked. They finally get a meeting with the Dubliners. I don't know if we know his name. I've just called him the Dubliner. But he's basically settling the deal. They ask him who killed Dixie. And I don't think he answers. But they give him some money that he's got to pay back Dublin a month because he needs more men and more cars. And he needs it now. And this also has the impact of the solicitor being called away. So Davy Hamill's been brought in over Dixie's murder, and the solicitor abandons sweet Davy and leaves him. But Davy's got a pretty good alibi, right?
Yeah. Also, I think the solicitor, you should give him really his full title, which is Northern Ireland Saul Goodman, who has also had a glow up. Absolutely wild. So I actually don't have many interesting things to say about this scene other than, do you not think that the Dubliner looked like a very young John Bishop?
Yeah, I do, definitely. Yeah. Now you said it. I knew there was something.
Now, my question is, I don't think this is a spoiler, but did you recognise him, Adam? You know, you rewatched the first series.
Is he there in that first series then with your man who gets shot?
I mean, he's taken over, right? We know he's his cousin, right?
Yes.
So I think they try and say that he was there, but I don't recognise that man from Adam. Do you, Adam?
I don't, no, not at all. But yeah, he definitely alludes to the fact that he was there before when his man got shot. Yeah, I don't think it was necessary particularly, but whatever. Let's talk a bit about Shane's moment stopping Rab. So they're doing these random stops. They've set up this perimeter, basically, and anyone who's driving through it gets stopped and searched. They're doing their PAPA checks, and it turns out that Rab, who's the old guy who's in the pub, has a history of a full life sentence for terrorist activities. He was released under the Good Friday Agreement, but, you know, he's clearly been well behaved since then, basically. And the kid Henry is in the car as well. So Shane is basically being a bit of a prick about the whole thing. And he says to Annie, you have to let them know who's boss. Whereas Annie's trying to get him to just let him go and move him along. But it has the effect of causing tension between Shane and Annie, but also giving Rab the right hump.
Well, it wouldn't be the first hump had there. I think also, importantly, Tommy sees that, and he, even though Annie's trying to be nice to him, he's already mouthing off. He's not a fan of the Peelers. But this is another incident of which bad policing brews bad feeling from the community. And also we see from Shane that classic thing of he gets laid and then he turns into an absolute arsehole. Instant buyer's remorse, I think, from Annie.
Yeah, he was very different to, you know, I keep a packet of fags on me so I can, you know, relate to people. The Shane from episode one, very different approach to police work. Yeah, she was quite confused, wasn't she?
That is all what you've just said, Damo. Apparent in the next scene we see with Jonty speaking to a group of residents and Lee confronts him in the community centre. Tells him Jim Dixon was a scumbag paramilitary. You knew that he was extracting protection money, basically saying it's all up to us now. You know, you're ineffectual. You failed this place. You failed us.
So I'm thinking here that what Lee's doing is essentially turning the community even more against the police, so that when he lies it with drugs, no one's going to talk. Is that what we're thinking?
So I believe, oh geez, I'm worried that I'm going to get into spoiler territory here. But I think it's more kind of a Robin Hood vibe, a kind of twisted Robin Hood vibe, whereas Mount Eden, his personal fiefdom, he wants to keep clean and all the product needs to go elsewhere. So Mount Eden will be like the Garden of Eden, I guess. That's why they've called it that, I'm assuming. And that stays sacrosanct under his watch, and that everywhere else can basically go to shit as long as his neighborhood is okay. He also says it's up to us to fix it. They don't stop paramilitaries, they work with them.
Yeah, but he's very much getting the community on his side and anti-police, and Shane's actions are kind of fueling all of that as well, I think. We get a nice little car chase, Sandra and Tommy chasing down Craig McQuarrie, our killer. And they find the money in the back of his car. That money that he's got to turn around and double in a week is gone, which is obviously going to cause Lee some difficulties.
Yeah, and that money is given by the Dubliners to help Lee grow his empire. It's a seed fund, I guess, venture capitalist Dubliners. They're not buying shares, are they, in the business? But yeah, that's to help bring Lee and his gang up to scratch, or up to snuff, if you will.
More cars, more people.
Wasn't that a song by Notorious B.I.G.? More cars, more people.
But the episode ends with Jonty back at the station saying that they've lost Mount Eden, and Lee showing up at the front desk asking for his money back. Very, very tense. And that's where we leave episode 3. Any other thoughts or theories, Grace?
Not at the moment. I think I've shared all my theories. I'm really enjoying it. Like today, I knew I was going to watch 2 episodes this afternoon, and I was really looking forward to it. So I'm loving it. It does feel different to season 1. It does, and I think that's important, and it has to, right? It can't be the same. But I don't know if it's. I think the whole series has had a glow up, and I don't quite know how I feel about it. But I'm still really enjoying it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think series 1, what it did so well was each episode was kind of a self-contained thing, despite the fact that there was this ongoing storyline going throughout it. So there was kind of the thing that they were dealing with in that episode. Whereas this one, I feel like there's some of that, but that feels like the side thing now. And we've got the bigger plot is the main storyline. And I think that's just the evolution of the show as it's going on. But yeah, thoroughly enjoying it. Episode 4, I also enjoyed, and I'm looking forward to watching the last 2. We'll be back fairly soon, as soon as we can, get together to record on episodes 4 and 5, and then also the finale, episode 6. We also have weekly spoiler-free watch list episodes. We're coming up for our 300th episode, which is still very exciting. And, oh, Grace, before we let you go, are you up for doing a bit of a challenge?
Oh, yeah. I've heard about this, but I have absolutely no idea what it is. 100% I'm in.
Okay, so you've got a score to beat from Damien. So there's two challenges, really. There's the challenge that I'm going to set you, which is the same challenge I set Damien. And then there's also the challenge of beating Damien's score.
Okay, oh my gosh.
So to set this up, EmpireOnline.com have released their 100 greatest TV shows of all time. The challenge for you is to name 10 of those 100 greatest without naming something that's not in there.
Empire is it an American platform? American magazine?
No, I think it's a British magazine, but there is obviously, you know, a good influence of American shows within that. So I don't think it's particularly skewed towards American shows or American viewers.
Also, one important rule that Adam didn't mention, the moment you say a show that isn't in the 100, it's over.
Okay, I'm just gonna go on instinct. I'm gonna go with The Wire.
The Wire is number 4 in the list.
The West Wing.
The West Wing is number 7 in the list.
Starting to get quite stressed already. I'm gonna save my risky one for later down the line. Fleabag.
Fleabag is in the list. Yes, it is number. Where is it? It's number 21.
Okay, lovely. Succession.
Succession's number 5 in the list.
The Sopranos.
The Sopranos is number 1. Yeah, that's the number 1 show on the list. So yeah, you've got 5 so far, halfway there.
ER.
ER. That's a good shout. Is ER in the list? But I'm not 100% sure. No,
stop it. It's wrong.
It's there. It's there. Good. It's number 36 in the list. ER. Well done.
Okay.
Now, at this point, I feel I should share some information that Adam shared with me, and that there are modern shows in there, more recent shows in there, 102.
Okay, great. Thank you for that, Damo. Just quick question. Do these shows have to have finished?
No.
The White Lotus.
Got to be 100. It has to be.
It's not there.
Stop it. No, get out. Get out of town.
It's not there. And you've been hoisted by the same petard. I think you've got 6, didn't you? So exactly the same score as Damien there. Yeah, the White Lotus wasn't there. What could she have had, Damo?
You couldn't have had The Bear, which is what I said. Well, could have had Game of Thrones, which I also didn't say. Mad Men. Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad.
Of course. You know, my risky one was going to be The Leftovers, which is one of my favourite TV series of all time. It's there. It's there. Of course it is. Highly regarded, I believe, The Leftovers. God damn it. Well, that was a fantastic game. Thank you so much.
Yeah, number 17, The Leftovers. So there you go. Well done. We'll have to see if Neil or Izzy can beat your score, but you've drawn level with Damien. So yeah, good effort.
I really want to play again.
It's a good list, worth checking out, I think. But yeah, that's it for us this week then. We'll be back soon. If you want to let us know what you're thinking of Blue Lights, let us know on the social media. No spoilers, please, at tvdnapod or by email to tvdnapod@gmail.com. Have you got a line to see us out there?
I just think we should take a beat, work-wise, everything-wise. Just take a beat, you know?
Not podcast-wise, though.
Oh, never. We'll be friends.
You knew, and you did nothing. You coming here is an insult to this community. Apologies for the poor accent.
My one is one of our favourite character, Jen's. She says, "It may lead nowhere, but we might find out the truth." To which I shouted at the screen, "You can't handle the truth!"
Lovely stuff.